From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is help on the way for home care workers? I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Labor Department is considering a rule change that would guarantee minimum wage and overtime pay to home care workers. Some 2.5 million workers provide home care to an increasingly aging population in the U.S. They're disproportionately women and minorities, and until now their work has been exempted from the Fair Labor Act. Will increased labor costs mean fewer people can afford to hire help for aging relatives at home? As baby boomers continue to swell the ranks of the elderly, how are we redefining old age? On Reporter's Notebook, the worst drought in a quarter of a century continues to spread across the U.S. First, the news.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point from PRI. Only 14 states require minimum wage and overtime pay for home care workers, but the U.S. Labor Department is considering a rule change that would extend those protections to all of the approximately 2.5 million workers caring for elderly Americans at home. As an aging population lives longer, what will be the cost of keeping seniors healthy? On Reporter's Notebook, a look at the impact of the record-breaking drought stretching across America. First, this news update. International mediator Kofi Annan today condemned atrocities in a reported massacre by Syrian forces in the village of Tremsa, where more than 200 Syrians, mostly civilians, were reported killed on Thursday, according to rebel forces. If confirmed, this would be the bloodiest sectarian incident of the 16-month-long uprising against the Syrian government. My guest is Abigail Fielding-Smith. She's the Financial Times correspondent in Beirut. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How much is known about what actually did happen yesterday?
Well, unfortunately, as is often the case with these mass killings in Syria, a lot of details are still unclear. Activists' estimates range between about a little over 100 to 220 of the number killed. And as you mentioned, International Envoy Kofi Annan has condemned the government for using heavy weapons in that area. So that's the sort of situation from one side, but also the regime say in the state media that the town was overrun by terrorists, which is the term they use to describe pretty much anyone who's opposed to them, and that the security forces responded to that. So there's a lot of competing narratives, and the activist groups themselves sometimes differ in points, but the overall picture is of there being sort of intense fighting and some heavy weapons used. The UN also said that helicopters were used. So it sounds like a very bad day indeed.
Kofi Annan's had particularly sharp criticism for the use of heavy weaponry, which the Syrian government had said it would not be using in accordance with the six-point peace plan he'd brought to them. What happened there?
Well, that's right. Some time ago, the Syrian government said that it was committed to this peace plan, which involved not using heavy weapons in populated areas. And then, obviously, since April, we've seen a lot of violence, and there was a lot of, disappointment in the plan. And Kofi Annan recently, in the past week even, has been trying to revive the plan, and he's been saying that, the Syrian government have assured me they are committed to it now. This really leads the whole of his last week of diplomacy in disarray.
As you pointed out, the last week of his diplomacy, the UN monitoring mission expires at the end of next week. What's the UN expected to do next?
Well, it's not clear because, on the one hand, the monitors haven't even been doing really sort of, although they do observe some things as they announced today, they haven't been able to do patrols since last month because of the levels of violence. And even when they were doing patrols, there was a lot of criticism that there were not enough of them and it wasn't doing anything to stop the violence. The problem is that, there's not really any other international policy on Syria that the world powers can agree on. Their mandate has to be decided upon because it's going to expire on the 20th of July. In the absence of any other agreed international policy on Syria or any bright ideas, it's hard to know, what they're going to do instead of renewing the mandate.
The monitors also haven't been able to get close enough to verify what happened in the village of Tremsa. Will it ever be verified as to what actually happened there?
Well, General Mood said that they stand by ready to go in and examine facts on the ground once there's a cessation of violence. Unfortunately, with previous mass killings or reported mass killings, we saw this pattern where the observers were unable to go in for some time afterwards due to the ongoing violence, which meant, therefore, that by the time they did get there, it was very difficult to sort of construct an authoritative account of who was responsible for the killing. That's problematic. And it's not even clear if violence will decrease enough for them to feel that they can go in there either.
And Kofi Annan is headed to Russia on Monday, right?
Yeah, that's where he's due to be headed, yeah.
What does he expect to accomplish there? Russia has not cracked down on the Syrian government.
Well, no, I mean, and one wonders where it leaves all of the sort of the shoring up he was doing in the past week. Russia issued a statement today saying, you know, that condemning the death, but not saying who was responsible, which is in contrast to the very sort of condemnatory statements from other powers. So I think, you know, it's really not clear how Kofi Annan, who's placed a lot of store on sort of getting the support of countries which are close to Syria in the past week, is going to square that now in the light of the events which took place on Thursday.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks.
Abigail Bye. Fielding-Smith is the Financial Times correspondent in Beirut. She joined us to talk about the atrocities committed yesterday in the village of Tremsa in Syria, where it's reported that more than 200 Syrians, mostly civilians, were killed on Thursday. We'll be back in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Sarah Terry, back with To the Point. In 1975, there were some 50 home care agencies across the United States. By 2009, there were nearly 6,600, with a workforce of 2.5 million people caring for the nation's elderly at home. Those workers have been exempted from minimum wage and overtime pay rules under an exemption in the Fair Labor Act, and the Department of Labor is now considering removing that rule. Labor advocates say the change is long overdue, but will increased costs mean fewer Americans will be able to afford to care for aging relatives at home? And speaking of overdue, who's planning ahead about how to care for a population that may include several million people over the age of 100 by the year 2050? My first guest today is Emily Friedman. She's an independent health policy and ethics analyst based in Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be there.
Tell us, let's start first with a conversation about this population, which seems almost hidden in terms of the way we talk about it and cover it, but is very apparent, really, in the world around us.
In the country of the young, we don't like to think in terms of the rapid aging of this society. But the fact is that two things have made it inevitable: an enormous increase in life expectancy during the 20th century, about 30 years, in fact, so that overall average life expectancy is pushing 80 for some groups, such as white women, much higher than that. So we're living longer. Second, the baby boom, although, of course, obviously we've lost some, was 76 million strong, all of them born in one 18-year period between 1946 and 1964. The result is you have this large lump in the society that is aging as a group. We have 9,000 people a day turning 50, and the projections are that we're going to be a pretty gray society by the middle of this century.
So are trends changing in the way that we care for the elderly, for our own aging relatives? And of course, we're discussing this in the context of the rule involving overtime pay and minimum wage for home care workers.
The trends long term have changed markedly. Originally, it was a family caregiving affair. And it should not be overlooked that the majority of caregiving for frail and disabled Americans is still provided, at least in part, by family members. But when you had multiple generations in one home, what I call the Walton family syndrome, then there were lots of people around to care for granny. These days, only about 4% of households fit that bill. The result is more formal caregiving became the norm. And through almost a fluke in the Medicaid statute, nursing homes became eligible for reimbursement under Medicaid. So a great many patients ended up in nursing homes, which is a very expensive means of care. More recently, the states particularly, which pay a lot of the freight for Medicaid, have been looking for ways to keep people out of nursing homes. And, of course, the most popular approach is community-based care, particularly home health care, which also answers something that the aging population has really demanded, and that is the right to stay in their homes as long as possible.
Tell us a little bit more about that home care industry. As I noted in the intro, there's been a huge explosion of the number of home care agencies. What home care workers do, who licenses them, what's the parameters of their work?
Well, it's all over the map. Roughly, there are a million home health care workers. That's out of a larger group of direct caregivers of one sort or another, of which there are over 3 million. But they work in various settings. In terms of home health aides, there are about a million of them. They are exempted, by the way, although I'm quite sure your other guests will be able to speak about this more expertly. They're exempted because in 1974, it was determined under the Fair Labor Standards Act that they provided companionship services. The focus of that ruling, however, was babysitters, not people who are starting IVs in people's homes, who are taking temperatures, who are doing clinical jobs, sometimes pretty sophisticated clinical jobs. And even though home health care is a win-win for just about everyone, folks can stay in their homes, the family gets a break and an appropriate level of care is provided. Quality is all over the map. Some states license and certify these providers. In other cases, it's pretty lax. There are a lot of what I would call shadow market homes, board and care homes, where people are simply kept in someone else's private homes. And increasingly, there is a direct employment of home health aides by families as opposed to going through an agency. And then, of course, there's the Wild West. Without any certification, licensure, examination, or monitoring, we don't know who these families are hiring.
What about the issue of pay for those home care workers? And they don't have minimum wage protection or overtime protection. What do you feel about the Labor Department's consideration of removing that exemption?
Well, I think it's appropriate. I think the home health care field, the employer side of it, make the argument, and they're correct to a degree, that this is going to increase costs. The states are not happy about it because, as I said, the states pay for a significant proportion of Medicaid costs. Medicaid is a very common payer of home health care services, so then their costs are going to go up. However, as I said, these are not babysitters. And my feeling is if higher pay is allowed under federal law, it will accomplish two or three things. The first one is it will pick up workers who aren't already covered by state law. Understand that many states have their own minimum wage requirements and that these workers are covered by them. Fewer states have paid overtime requirements, but they do have them. So to a certain extent, you're sort of picking up the straggler states by saying these people have to be paid something within the realm of reason. I saw a report the other day that 40% of home health care workers are on food stamps, and I have to question just the justice of that. The second thing that we have seen with a variety of federal actions in and out of healthcare, if the federal government does something or approves of something or inaugurates something, the private sector tends to follow. So we could see a change in the attitude toward these workers, that they are not, in fact, babysitters and companions. The third thing that I think could happen, which I do feel is important, And our colleague, Mr. Reynolds, can speak to this as his agency is very interested in improving the quality of care.
That's an upcoming guest, yes?
Yes. Some of the, as I said, some states are pretty lax about regulation. If higher wages and overtime and so forth could contribute toward agencies having a bit of extra money to do quality data reporting, to maybe it will goose some states into saying, let's see who's providing these home health services, because there have been scandals. The wrong people have been hired, and bad things have resulted. In a time when the acute care sector is rolling hell-bent toward improvement of quality of care, there are too many areas of senior care that remain backwaters, and you're dealing with very vulnerable patients.
We'll be bringing that up, of course, in, as the show continues. We're talking to Emily Friedman, Independent Health Policy and Ethics Analyst. I'd like to bring in Phil Toledano. He's a photographer and artist. His website, dayswithmyfather.com, chronicles the days he spent during the last years of his father's life. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I was hoping you could bring sort of a more personal aspect to our story today. Tell us a bit about what happened with you and your father.
Sure. My mom died very unexpectedly in 2006, and I suddenly found myself in charge of my father, in charge of another person's life. And also, surprisingly, I was surprised to find out that my father had some form of dementia that my mom had, I guess, protected me from. So in very short order, I had to figure out what to do with my dad, how to live with him, how to make sure that his life was going to be okay for as long as he was going to be around for. So I moved in with him for the first few months while I was trying to figure out what was going to happen. And basically, I guess I went to a lot of homes to look at whether I would put my father in a home. But to be honest, it was so heartbreaking to see the conditions, to think of him in such a situation that I ended up deciding to keep him in his own home.
This was in New York?
This is in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, New York City. And I ended up deciding to keep him at home and hiring some, I guess, caregivers to be with him. And then since I'm a photographer and an artist, I obviously have some time on my hands, which is kind of fantastic, or was fantastic at the time. So I'd spend 3 or 4 days a week with him, but there'd also be caregivers there at the same time.
What kind of work did the home care workers give to your father, and what kind of care did they give your father?
I mean, it was really very basic. It was just sort of feeding him, washing him, being there and talking to him. Thankfully, he wasn't physically unwell, so it was not a lot of care, but he just needed to have someone with him, and I couldn't be there all the time to do that.
And how did you find those workers? Did you go through an agency? Did you find them independently?
Yeah, I mean, when my mom died, I guess it was this sort of maelstrom of panic and terror, and I was just overwhelmed by everything. And I remember looking through her papers and remembering that at one point she had tried to hire someone to help her take care of my father. And I found those papers, and it was an agency, and I called them up, and they sent over some people. And it took 2 or 3 months to sort of find someone who could manage my father in a way that I thought was right, who could treat him in a way that I thought was beautiful and respectful, all that kind of thing. So, but then I found two people, one during the day and one at night, and we sort of settled into a routine.
You know, let's talk, if you don't mind, a little bit about the financial issues involved in this.
Sure.
What did it cost you? Where did your resources come from?
It was an enormous amount of money. It was probably about $100,000 a year. I mean,
for how many years?
For my father was 94 when my mom died, and he died when he was 99.
Okay.
In 2009, so it was 4 years. I mean, sorry, 95 when my mom died, so it was 4 years. I mean, look, basically I was eating into whatever money I was going to inherit, but that didn't matter because the most important thing to me was that I could make him as happy as possible whatever time he had left. And that seemed to me like the only possible solution because he couldn't move in with us, with my wife and I, because we didn't have the space. So that seemed like the next best solution.
And on a personal level, you know, what was your experience of those later years with your father? We heard from Emily Friedman, you know, in a culture that, you know, presents itself as perpetually young, we don't like dealing with issues of aging and dying.
Well, I will say, I had a lot of talks actually with Lucilla, the woman who took care of my dad during the day, and she was, I was actually quite stunned to hear this, but she said she over her, because of her experience, she had the amount of children who visited their parents. I mean, basically, she said kids would drop by maybe once a month, if that, for a couple of hours. And I was a particularly unusual case, but I really felt, my sense was that from talking to her, that old people they're refuse in this country, and where I'm from in England, for that matter. I mean, once they're done, they're just packed away somewhere, and you know, hopefully the dying is as least offensive and at least painful for everyone involved as possible. But I really felt very strongly that my parents had been there to take care of me when I was unable to take care of myself, and the least I could do was return the favor to my dad. And as an experience, it was beautiful and excruciating and painful and funny and sad. It was all those things at once. It was a lot of stuff. I mean, I can tell you that I don't think my father wanted to be alive, and he didn't want to be around, and he used to tell me that on a regular basis. And it's pretty painful as the only child to hear that your dad doesn't want to be alive. But I understood that, because his wife of 50 years had suddenly vanished. He didn't really understand where she'd gone.
Can you tell us, just, we've got to take a break in a minute, but just sure. Let's start briefly with what you captured in the photographs of your father, which can be seen on your website, dayswithmyfather.com.
Basically, I just wanted to remember our experience together. So I took photographs of my dad and our life together, and I wrote about it. And it's not about aging, and it's not about dementia. It's essentially a love letter from me to my father. I consider the last 3 or 4 years of my dad's life, I consider myself lucky, because I got to say goodbye to him, and he got to say goodbye to me in a very beautiful way, and I feel lucky that that happened.
Phil Teledana is a photographer and artist. His website, dayswithmyfather.com, chronicles the time he spent with his father during the last years of his life. He's staying with us in the second half of the show. On Reporter's Notebook, coming up later, drought conditions have now reached nearly two-thirds of the United States, but just a year ago, much of the Midwest was flooded. What's up? We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI. Subscribe to the To The Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To The Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To The Point. We're talking about home health care workers and who cares for America's elderly and who will be caring for them in the future. I'd like to bring Jim Reynolds into the conversation. He's CEO of Caring Companion Home Care, a home care agency in Massachusetts. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You know, just before the break, we were speaking with Phil Toledano about his experience in providing home care for his father. It cost nearly $100,000 a year for him over 4 years, each of those years. Not everybody can afford that kind of care. I'm curious, you know, what are the costs associated with home care work? Is it that expensive for everybody?
Well, no, obviously, or wouldn't be, more people wouldn't have it. I don't obviously know the details of his scenario. One thing he mentioned was he was in Manhattan, and, you know, it costs a lot to do anything in Manhattan. And any number that even approaches something like that sounds to me like it would be, you know, 24-hour care day in, day out.
He did have 24-hour care, he said.
Right. So that, and that
well,
is
what's a typical what's a typical Sorry. Case of somebody who's looking for home health care?
You know, it can go anywhere from, you know, we took away Dad's keys, he can't drive anymore, somebody needs to come by once a week and make a run to the grocery store, do a couple of loads of laundry, that kind of thing, to, you know, people who need daily visits, and certainly we, you know, my agency does a number of live-in cases, 24-hour cases, or you may do 3 or 4 or 5 times a week for, you know, 4 hours or 6 or 8 hours or you know, all day. So it varies.
How do you find your workers? Emily Friedman raised a few questions earlier on in the show about licensing issues, about knowing who workers are, where they come from, tracking this economy and workforce.
I think she's, you know, spot on there as far as the importance of that. One place I would give a lot of credit is to our industry association in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Home Care Alliance. They have an accreditation program. We're accredited. I don't know how many agencies are, maybe I think 50 or 100. But there's a set of standards of, you know, criminal background checks and driver's licenses checks and nurse registry checks and former employers and you know, those kinds of backgrounds that you need to do in order to be sure that someone at least is, you know, not a risk going in there, that you can't guarantee there's going to be a good match with the family. But you can generally weed out the folks who really shouldn't be doing the work in the first place.
How many workers are in your labor force, your agency?
In my agency?
Mm-hmm.
Well, off the top of my head, I don't know. Probably 50 or so.
And where do you find them?
I mean, we advertise the same way you do any other job placement. And in our case, back with the stuff that Emily was just talking about, we advertise only on the web because we use the internet a lot to transfer information to clients. After every visit, we put up a report that the family can see so they can see how their parent is doing. So we only use internet job applications. But
you know, I'm curious, the statistics show that in general across the country that these home care workers are disproportionately women and minorities. And I'm wondering if that holds true in the people that you work with at your agency.
Certainly women. I mean, and I should also clarify, there are a number of categories here. When Emily was speaking before, I think she was talking mainly about, I don't want to be too technical, but certified Medicare agents, people who are doing, you know, you start giving shots and things like that. The area where I deal is private duty, more like people who are working for Phil, you know, who might go stay many, many hours in a place. And that tends not to be certified medical work. And in that area, the family has a great deal of discretion. He mentioned saying it took him a while to find people that he thought were a good match with his father. Families, you will find, request women at an enormous rate, at about an 80% rate. So that's what you wind up with just because people demand it.
And what's the hourly wage that workers receive through your agency?
Well, my agency is a little higher than even Massachusetts, and Massachusetts is above the national average. But in my agency, it's between $13 and $15 an hour.
So well above minimum wage.
Oh, yes.
And so I'm curious then what your thoughts would be on the Labor Department's consideration of changing the exemption for home care workers so that they do get mandated minimum pay and overtime.
I shouldn't say that. I think most people pay minimum wage, but I could be wrong. I think the overtime issue is a significant one, certainly when the families are paying. I mean, can you imagine what Phil's costs would have been if it was, you know, if he had to pay time and a half on that as well. So I think the effect on families would be enormous. I think also, by the way, What happens, the effect, I mean, and I should say, by the way, in Massachusetts, we do pay overtime. So I don't really have a dog in the fight in terms of I'm not going to make any more or less money if they pass that law, because in Massachusetts, we pay overtime.
Does the overtime come, is it charged to the client, or does it come through the agencies, come from your profits?
Well, I mean, it comes from our profits, but what we do is raise the price to the agents, to the
clients. Okay.
In other words, if the family has somebody who's been there 40 hours, we say, well, we'd be happy to send, Marianne again tomorrow if you like, but it will now be, $40 an hour. Or if you want, you can have somebody else. And they always say, send somebody else. And so Marianne, I'm making up a name, gets cut off at 40 hours rather than being able to work 50 or 60. And I don't think that's a small consideration, because the effect is real. And, there's somebody who would have liked to work more and then can't. And I think that's worth considering. There's a lot in that regulation, by the way, that we can't go into today. That's pretty complex.
I'm sure. I'm just curious, from your perspective, this is a family business. It's been run for quite some time. What are the trends that you've noticed? What are the changes you've seen in our attitudes towards caring for the elderly and caring for them at home?
Well, certainly. Well, the caring from home, I think the comments have been made are right. Everybody prefers to be at home. I think the multi-generational effect trend that Emily mentioned earlier is definitely noticeable. Many people are remote from the parent, and I think that certainly causes a problem. I think probably the solution, and I don't know if the solution, the best way to address this going forward will involve more community-based care. But it won't necessarily all be through agencies. It may be volunteers or faith communities or neighbors or things like that, providing some of it some of the time just because of the costs.
We're talking to Jim Reynolds, CEO of Caring Companion Home Care. I'd like to bring Eileen Boris into the conversation. She's Hall Professor and Chair of Department of Feminist Studies at UC Santa Barbara and co-author with Jennifer Klein of Yale University of Caring for America, Home Health Workers in the Shadow of the Welfare State. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you give us a bit of a historical perspective on home care workers?
Sure. I think it's very important to realize that this was an occupation that was made and thus can be changed. Home care originated as a distinct job amid the crisis of the Great Depression. And the label companion rests on an assumption that elder caretaking was merely a casual undertaking. In fact, after World War II, it was an occupation shaped quite specifically as part of welfare and health policy through cooperation and contestation between social work and medical professionals, government and public employees, providers and receivers, state and federal governments, and competing state agencies themselves. And it's really important to understand then that the notion of an elder companion as a job is introduced with the 1975 interpretation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So if we have a series of kinds of jobs that develop over time, visiting housekeeper, a reverse foster care homemaker, health aides, and throughout this process, there are specific government acts that are passed that encourage this profession. And always from the beginning, it is one of those private-public that is agencies that are both nonprofit and profit, family social welfare agencies, staffing agencies that are working in tandem with state and local governments, fueled by a combination of federal money and local money.
What impact do you think changing populations and population trends in the United States will have on the way we view and treat home health care workers?
One thing that's really apparent is that if we look at who increasingly, both in the shadow economy, the gray economy as it's often called, and the formal economy, that the people that are doing the care are, by and large, middle-aged women, and to some extent, there are students who do this as part-time work, but increasingly we're having an aging baby boom generation of white individuals being cared by immigrant women of color, disproportionately. And that says something about, you know, who's going to care for the boomers and the ways in which not only gender inequalities, but race and citizenship status and ethnicity feed into these questions.
If you could set the agenda for the nation's conversation on home care and on caring for the elderly as we move forward, what would you say we should be talking about?
I think we should first not talk about a zero-sum game. That is, that if you give better working conditions and make home care into a decent job, somehow that means fewer hours for our loved ones. So we have to stop that kind of opposition and try to figure out how we can all work together. I'm a great proponent of community-based care, of having all the stakeholders in the room together. But one thing is apparent. Right now, less than 10% of home care workers are actually working overtime. The job has been structured as a casual part-time job. The problem is most home care workers are involuntarily part-time workers. So the first thing is to make it into a good job, treated like all other jobs. The second thing is not to penalize people who do care work. Not everyone can be as fortunate as Phil was to have that kind of time to spend with their loved one in their end of life and not have a big penalty in terms of their work lives. And so one proposal that feminists have presented is for caregiver credit under Social Security. People who have to take time out of the labor force for caregiving, whether it's children or elders, are often penalized, and we have to stop that.
We're talking to Eileen Boris, co-author of Caring for America, Home Health Workers in the Shadow of the Welfare State. Phil Toledano, photographer and artist who documented his days with his father during the final years of his life. You're a visual person. We talked earlier in the show about the sort of perception and the feeling that elderly are just sort of considered waste to be shuffled away. I'm wondering if it was in your domain to set a conversation on the way we consider the elderly. What would it look like? What's your visual sense of it? How would you be causing us to think differently?
Well, actually, and in some ways, the work that I did with my father, documenting that experience, it's had a really profound effect on me in a very surprising way. In the sense that since that website went up, there's about 2 million people have been to that site. And I've gotten tens of thousands of emails from people all over the world. And a lot of those emails say to me, a lot of those people who write to me say that that those pictures and that writing has made them reconsider the idea of what it means to say goodbye to their parents.
Hmm.
And it's been an extraordinary honor and joy and privilege to be on the receiving end of that kind of reaction. So I guess that's what I'd say. I think you just have to reframe the whole. You have to reframe the whole thing. You have a choice when you say goodbye to your parents. It can be a beautiful experience or not. And I know I'm fully cognizant of the fact that I was particularly lucky that my parents had the wherewithal to be able to pay for the enormous costs of home care. But nevertheless, you can make it an extraordinary experience or not, and it's up to you. But I also think it requires a cultural shift in terms of how we consider aging and how valuable we consider our parents and the elderly. And in this particular culture, amongst others, I don't think we do, really, sadly.
Phil Toledano's website is dayswithmyfather.com. I'm going to keep asking this question of the rest of the guests on the show. Jim Reynolds, CEO of Caring Companion Home Care, how would you set the nation's sort of cultural conversation in the years ahead as we confront an increasingly aging population?
Well, one thing I'm going to give an unsolicited plug for Phil's website. I saw that once I saw his name, and it is beautiful.
Hmm.
And in fact, to refer back to that, I would say, as we do all of this, that aging is a phase of life. It's not a disease to be cured like mumps. And the more that even as people age, there are many days, as he said earlier, where there can be a lot of laughter, a lot of tears. You don't necessarily have the same relationship you had before, but if people can accept that, I think there is a lot of grace that can happen in those days. As far as the direct care workers and the labor force, I would agree with the professor. I think we need more more community-based care. I think that will be a big help. And I think that I certainly agree that there are a lot, you know, the problems with regulations is some of them do create jobs like this, as she was saying. You know, a home care worker, for example, can't take the top off a bottle of medicine. And you know, the neighbor can or the family member can, but the home care worker can't. And so that drives the work to a nurse who costs a lot more. So you have a lot of issues around that are difficult and do create discrete jobs that are lower valued. And I think if we could continue to move in that direction, I think that will help us.
Jim Reynolds is CEO of Care and Companion Home Care in Massachusetts. We'll give the final word in the show to Emily Friedman, who we started with, independent health policy and ethics analyst based in Chicago. If you got to set the agenda for having a conversation about how to change our attitudes, our plans, our approaches to caring for the elderly and to aging in America, what would it look like?
I would have two conversations. I beg your pardon, allergies. Conversation number one is this country is awash in all kinds of interest in health policy for acute care. Long-term care, whether you're talking about the Affordable Care Act, reimbursement, the kinds of things we've talked about today in terms of quality, licensure, certification, scope of practice, we still don't want to deal with it. We're not alone in that. Many other societies have the same problem. But as I said, the demographic trends are set in stone. We're getting old. We can either have policy for payment, for care, for organized systems of care that are going to recognize us and provide the best possible care, or we can keep on ignoring it, and then at some point the dam will break. The other conversation is a cultural conversation to pick up on Phil's point that being old should not be a crime. There's a bioethicist named John Kilner who was so horrified by a number of proposals in this country that old people simply should only receive palliative care beyond a certain age. Keep them comfortable, let them die. He went to Africa and lived with a tribe when he asked that question. Well, if you only had one person to save and you had an old person and a young person, they said, oh, well, we would save the old person because their lives are woven into the fabric of our society.
Hmm.
The lives of the greatest generation, everyone talks about the greatest generation, and yet we won't develop policy, we won't develop high regard for them, and we will not understand, as Jim said, being old isn't a disease, it's a phase of life.
Well, that's all the time we've got today for this conversation. Thanks so much for bringing us to that point of considering the elderly's lives as woven into the fabric of our lives. Emily Friedman is an independent health policy and ethics analyst. Thanks to her and our other guests, Phil Toledano, photography and artist. His website is dayswithmyfather.com. Jim Reynolds of Caring Companion Home Care, and Eileen Boris, chair of the Department of Feminist Studies at UC Santa Barbara. The worst drought in a quarter of a century continues to spread across the United States. More than 1,000 counties have been declared natural disaster areas. That's coming up on Reporter's Notebook. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_kcrw. Thank you.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney today. It's time for Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. Just a year ago, heavy rains and swollen rivers led to historic flooding in the Midwest. Yet this summer, drought is spreading across the region and threatening crops. It's the worst drought in 25 years, and it comes in the midst of a record-breaking period of high temperature. According to statistics just released by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the last 12 months is the warmest 12-month period in the U.S. since record-keeping began in 1895. My guest today is Carrie Gillum. She's a correspondent for Reuters based in Kansas City, where she focuses on agriculture and food. She spent this week touring drought-stricken areas in the Midwest. She joins us from the road. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Hi, you know, first, let's take a snapshot of what you're seeing and what's happening on the ground.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, it's been a lot of hot and dry driving days for us. We went through a lot of Missouri. I had a TV producer with me from New York and a photographer as well, because we really wanted to try to tell the stories of farmers and ranchers who are being so hard hit by the drought. And we went through parts of Missouri, which is one of these states that's been declared a disaster by USDA, disaster area. And we went up into Iowa primarily because Iowa is, a top U.S. corn and soybean production state. It is the number one state for both corn and soybeans, and really visited with a lot of farmers and ranchers there. And it's just such a sad story, and they're so frustrated right now. You know, the corn is rolling up on itself in the fields, stalks that should be 7-8 feet tall by now, or in some fields, knee high, maybe waist high.
Which was the 4th of July, according to those old farming.
Well, yeah, but actually a lot of the corn was planted early this year, so it should be even further along at this point.
Hmm.
And it's a key point. It's pollination time right now for the crop, and if it doesn't get enough moisture, it can't pollinate. A lot of farmers right now said they hope that they only have a 25 or 30% reduction in their yield. That would be a best case for them. So,
who's most affected, as you found? Are there big agri-farms, corporations that are affected, or is it family farmers?
Well, when we talk about farmers these days, and especially across Iowa or the big production states, I mean, these farmers are farming 2,000, 3,000 acres, one farmer 6,500 acres I talked to. So I don't know if that fits your definition of a family farm. Indeed, for them, it is a family farm.
Well, they're not owned by Monsanto, so I guess that counts.
They're not owned by Monsanto, but of course, a lot of them are contract producers, a Cargill or an ADM or something. So these guys are growing the corn and the soybeans that's feeding, the livestock and us and the people and here in the U.S. and China and around the world. So it's a big deal when you lose that much of a crop.
And what are the effects of last year's flooding on this year's crops and drought? Was there earlier planting? Was there it's such a dramatic swing in weather conditions.
Yeah, it really is. A lot of them did plant early. They had high hopes. They thought there was good moisture. They really thought this was going to be a good crop. There was a record, number of acres planted to corn in the United States this spring. Some of the areas that were flooded more heavily last year, the soil, there was a little more moisture, especially along the riverbank areas, the riverbeds. There was more moisture held in the soil. Sort of depends on what kind of soils you had, but some of those areas are still holding on. But a lot of the others are just, I talked to a farmer yesterday who said he's got his insurance agent out there and he's begging the guy to just let him bush hog it. He just wants to mow it all down. Doesn't want to.
What are the insurance protections he has? A sort of a guaranteed cost at a low rate for his crops, or?
Well, for grain producers around the United States, there are various sorts of insurance protections that if they choose to insure their crops, they can try to lock in basically a break-even. They try to insure for at least the cost that it incurs to them to grow the corn. Now, for cattlemen, they usually don't have that kind of protection, and the cattlemen right now in the Midwest are really getting hurt because they their pastures are burning up. They don't have anywhere for their cows are running out of grass to eat. That there's not a lot of grass to hay. There's not a lot of area to cut for hay because that's all burned up. If they want to try to feed them grain, the corn prices right now are just going through the ceiling, And so a lot of them are trying to just sell off their herds, liquidate their herds. They can't feed them. They can't water them. A lot of, you know, I talked to ranchers who said they're trying to haul water because their creeks are running dry, the ponds are dry. You know, but if they take them to market, nobody wants to buy them because they don't want to feed them. And if they're not getting the money out of them, it's a real hard time for ranchers too. So
I'm curious that, you know, with being a county being declared a natural disaster area, I think there's 1,016 counties that have been designated as that. What's that actually mean? What are you qualified for? What do you get when you're in a natural disaster area? Who helps you?
Well, the details of that are pretty specific, but one of the main things that the farmers and the ranchers and a lot of the government people I was talking to this week, one of the key things it means for them is that they can open up land that's been set aside in these conservation reserve programs. And what that means is they can put cattle in there, they can let them eat it, they can, you know, cut it for hay. It really gives them some breathing room on that. And
land certified for conservation purposes, you just said?
Yeah, through conservation reserve programs. Farmers, there are programs for farmers to set land aside.
Are these kicking up any local controversies?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I didn't run across any of that.
Environmentalists aren't coming out and protesting.
Mm-hmm. No. This is really part of a longstanding USDA program for farmers and ranchers, and it's not a huge change right now for them. And not all of that land is being allowed out. There's only certain parts of it, and there's only certain parts of it that are being allowed for hay and grazing. And every farmer has to go in and has to file an application, and he has to be reviewed before he's approved. It's a bureaucratic process.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Carrie Gillum is a correspondent for Reuters based in Kansas City. The producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Anna Scott, and Caitlin Schamberg. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Our managing producer is Sonia Geis. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On the next To the Point, Mitt Romney is raking in record amounts of cash for a Republican and outpacing even President Obama's own prodigious fundraising. How decisive will money be in the race? Where's it all coming from? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.